This is class 3 in the course on economics. In the last lecture, we considered the material in chapters 3, 4, and 5. Please make sure to turn in your assignments for chapters 3, 4, and 5 that are due. Today, we consider chapters 6 and 7 in the textbook. Chapter 6 and 7, beginning with chapter 6, which is entitled Theft Through Inflation. This takes up the topic even that we were considering in the last lecture. I would like to read now highlights from chapter 6. Reading now various quotes from chapter 6. The body vested with the authority to determine the supply of U.S. dollars in the economy is the Federal Reserve System. And now I'm speaking of, in this chapter, what is the current system, not the system that was in place following the formation of the U.S., but rather what has been in place most of the 20th century and beyond. So the body which is responsible for determining the supply of U.S. dollars is the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System consists of the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Open Market Committee, the Federal Advisory Council, and 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. The Fed, which is a short way of describing the Federal Reserve, especially the Federal Reserve Board, the Fed uses three tools to set the level of money supply. Of the three methods the Fed applies to change reserves in the economy, open market operations is the most important and the most frequently used. The term refers to the Fed's activity of buying and selling government securities or bonds. To put more money into circulation, the Fed buys bonds from people, businesses, or banks who hold them. These groups would receive cash in exchange for the bond, which puts funds in circulation and increases the money supply. The reverse occurs when the Fed sells bonds. This takes funds out of circulation and decreases the money supply. So the first tool that the Fed has for changing the quantity of money in supply in the economy is by these open market operations whereby they either buy or sell U.S. government bonds and other securities. A second tool the Fed employs is the reserve requirement. When the Fed increases the reserve requirement, that is the amount a bank is required to keep on hand as a percentage of its deposits, it forces banks to make fewer loans. One thing that should be pointed out relating to this reserve requirement is over time, the Federal Reserve Board has been gradually and progressively reducing the reserve requirement that banks have to keep, as far as the money that they have to keep on hand as percentage of the deposits that they have based upon people who've deposited money in their banks. So this second tool which the Fed has of changing the money supply, since the reserve requirement has, what the reserve requirement has been reduced over time, it has had the effect of increasing the money supply. A third tool the Fed employs is the discount rate. The discount rate is the interest rate which a bank must pay the Fed when the bank borrows money from the Fed. The more money a bank borrows, the more it can loan out, and the more it increases the money supply. So this third tool is the discount rate. The Federal Reserve System uses a number of different measures to quantify the amount of money which exists in the economy. The narrowest definition, M1, contains the most liquid forms of money. M1 includes all coins and currency in circulation with the public, plus money in checking or transaction accounts, plus traveler's check. These forms of money are used to directly purchase goods and services. A little more broad than the M1 definition of money is the M2 definition. It includes everything in M1 plus savings deposits plus money market mutual funds plus money market deposit accounts plus other short-term money market investments. Broader yet are M3 and L. Over time, as I've mentioned, the Fed has tended to inflate the supply of money. And you will see in your textbook on page 37 a graph showing the growth of the money supply since 1980, measured by M3. As a consequence of inflating the supply of money over time, each dollar becomes worth less and less. The official government measure of the worth of a U.S. dollar is the Consumer Price Index, called the CPI, for Consumer Price Index. This figure is a weighted average price of a typical basket of consumer goods and services. The term weighted means that price increases of goods that are bought in large quantities increase the CPI more than goods which are not consumed as commonly. A rising CPI over time means the typical basket of consumer goods and services is rising in price, which means the value of the dollar is decreasing over time. And you will see on page 38 of your textbook how the Consumer Price Index has increased over time. As the money supply is inflated and the value of the dollar has declined, the price in dollars of various commodities has not surprisingly risen over time. The rise in commodity prices is in fact another measure of the declining value of the dollar. And you will see in the textbook various examples of how the price of commodities have increased over time. Whether those commodities have been things like oil or gold. It also discusses how even in terms of what is called the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the stock market, how so much of the price increase or appreciation in stock prices is due not necessarily to real increases in value, but rather increases simply relating to inflation. In real inflation-adjusted terms, the rising price of publicly traded stocks has not been nearly as impressive as in nominal terms. The gains are even further eroded after tax effects are considered. For instance, suppose that over a decade the price of a stock increases by 20%, while price inflation also runs at 20%. In real terms, there was no gain in stock value. Nevertheless, if one sold the stock at the end of the decade, the U.S. federal government, along with perhaps one state government, would tax the nominal gain. So in real terms, considered after taxes, the value of one's investment under this hypothetical case would actually decrease. What is true of investments is essentially true of wages as well. Nominal wages have significantly risen over time. But real inflation-adjusted wages have not risen as significantly. And there are many harmful effects related to inflation. And some of these are described and outlined in your chapter. But the primary flaw with inflation is that it is immoral because it is indeed a form of theft. By increasing the money supply, the government is taking wealth away from those who are forced to have and hold its mandated currency. Okay, and now with respect to Chapter 7. Chapter 7 describes exchange rates in a fiat currency world. I'm going to, again, read some highlights from this chapter. Countries buy and sell thousands of different kinds of goods to and from each other. Because countries in the modern world have different fiat currencies, whether the U.S. dollar, the Canadian dollar, the Japanese yen, the Chinese renminbi, the EU's euro, etc. These need to be exchanged before the goods can be purchased. For example, if a United States importing business purchases Japanese cars, it must first buy Japanese yen in exchange for its own dollars before it can pay for the Japanese cars. Most currency exchange rates currently fluctuate. Fluctuating exchange rates affect what an importing business ends up paying for the foreign good. For instance, if the value of the Japanese yen relative to the U.S. dollar rises, then the Japanese products purchased by American businesses become more expensive. Since fiat currencies are generally not tied to gold or silver, there is not only a fluctuating exchange rate among fiat currency, there is also a fluctuating exchange rate with gold and silver. Countries can decide to allow their foreign exchange rates to increase or decrease, that is, they can adopt flexible exchange rates. Exchange rates are nothing more than prices buyers face for purchasing foreign currency, similar to a price a buyer faces for purchasing a commodity like a car. Prices or rates of currencies relative to other foreign currencies fluctuate according to their demand and supply relative to the demand and supply of other foreign currencies. So some money exchange rates fluctuate. Some currencies are allowed to have what is called flexible exchange rates. But some countries prefer to keep their currency value fixed relative to other foreign currencies. For instance, some Asian countries have chosen to have their currency fixed relative to the U.S. dollar. Countries trading with each other experience inflows and outflows of goods and services and accompanying flows of money used to pay for these goods and services. An accounting system called the balance of payments is kept to keep track of all these flows. The balance consists of two major accounts, the current account and the capital account. The current account is subdivided into four smaller accounts: the merchandise trade account, the services account, the investment income account, and the transfer payments account. The merchandise trade account includes imports and exports of tangible goods such as cars, computer, clothes, televisions, etc. If a country imports more than it exports in this category, then it is said to have a trade deficit. On the other hand, if it exports more than it imports, that would be called a trade surplus. A negative balance on the current account means that the country is considered a debtor nation. The capital account, on the other hand, includes a variety of subaccounts all dealing with the purchases and sale of financial assets or real estate. The balance on the capital account is the sum of the changes in the what are called capital subaccounts. But essentially, the capital account, again, just to keep this in mind, it's dealing with purchases and sales of financial assets or real estates. I think the best way to understand this better is by an illustration. In order to help illustrate this accounting system for balance of payments, as well as exchange rates, let me give you an example. Right now, the U.S. is purchasing more goods from China than it is selling to China. The United States trade deficit with China increased from $6.2 billion in 1989 to $124 billion in 2003 to $202 billion in 2005. So each year, the pattern has been that the trade deficit for that year has increased. The U.S. gives China U.S. dollars in exchange for goods made in China. The U.S. is running a current account deficit, therefore, with China. But China has to do something with those U.S. dollars. What it has primarily been doing is by is buying financial assets in the U.S. For example, it has been purchasing U.S. government bonds in some U.S. companies. So the U.S. is running a capital account surplus with China. The current account deficit with China has been roughly equal to the capital account surplus. Again, I want to repeat, the current account more takes into account the purchase or sell of goods and services, whereas the capital account more has to do with the purchase of financial assets or real estate. So what again has been happening is China has been buying things like U.S. government bonds, which is like a financial asset. So the U.S. has been running a capital account surplus since it has been selling these to China. But on the other hand, China has been exporting more than the U.S. exported to China, so that the U.S. has been running a current account deficit with China. China has kept its currency, the renminbi, fixed to the U.S. dollar by making sure to purchase about as many U.S. financial assets and real estate as it sells in goods and services to the U.S. In other words, by making sure that it's not just hoarding these dollars or throwing them out into the marketplace, but instead is buying these U.S. government bonds, it's used this as a method of keeping its own currency fixed to the U.S. dollar. So there is an example of a fixed exchange rate, that between the Chinese currency and the U.S. dollar. But let's say that at some time in the future, China got tired of accumulating U.S. financial assets like U.S. government bonds. Let's say instead it wanted to purchase European Union bonds with those U.S. dollars. That would mean in the world currency market the supply of U.S. dollars would increase, while the demand for European Union euros would increase. The value of the U.S. dollar would then decrease relative to foreign currencies like the euro. What used to take 80 U.S. dollars to buy may now take 120 U.S. dollars to buy. Since foreign products would rise in price, Americans might eventually stop buying so many foreign products. So America's current account deficit in the future then would decrease. And since foreigners had become less interested in purchasing U.S. financial assets, the U.S. capital account surplus would also decrease. So we see in this example how over time a nation's balance of payments may change while also the exchange rate of its currency changes. So what you'll want to do is you'll want to read chapter 6 and 7 and study the material. The assignments for chapter 6 and 7 are due by the class actually 2 weeks from now. So actually we will have another class and then a class before those assignments are due. Those who want to do the extra credit work should do the work described in Exhibit 2 to these lectures. Just as a reminder, in order to get a higher grade in this course, it is necessary to do that extra credit work. And the nature of that extra credit work is described in Exhibit 2.